Hello, this is Alex Hannaford, and welcome to Battleground.
Hello, I'm producer Pete. Hello, Alex.
Hello, Pete.
What's coming up in today's episode?
Black Lives Matter. Barely any explanation necessary.
The arrest of George Floyd.
Knee on Floyd's neck.
Death of George Floyd.
Black Lives Matter.
We were going to give an explanation. Obviously, it's a massive story that is all over the news. What I'd like to know is, how does it feed into the election and Trump in particular?
So it's become an election issue because kids who were 14 years of age 4 years ago are now of voting age this year, and they are the people, or among the people certainly, marching and protesting the deaths of black men and women at the hands of police in the United States.
And then on the flip side, Trump.
Violent mobs, arsonists, looters.
Would appear to be using the Black Lives Matter protests when they have turned violent and there have been skirmishes with the police. He's been sort of using those to his advantage and sort of using them to speak directly to his base.
Yeah, calling for, you know, I am the president of law and order, which really resonates with a conservative base. So yeah, he's using it to his political advantage.
Tell us who we're speaking to today then about Black Lives Matter.
Today we're talking to the executive director for the Black Alliance for Just Immigration.
LA civil rights attorney Nana Jamfi.
Her name's Nana Jamfi.
We know more about what's going on with police shootings in this country because of the cell phone and the cell phone camera.
She is a very lively interview. You'll hear her during the interview refer to her organization by its acronym, BAJI, B-A-J-I. She was raised on black nationalism and studied Africana studies at Cornell.
We are increasingly bombarded by the rhetoric that the U.S. government and all its smaller governments are committed to upholding freedom, justice, equality, and constitutional rights.
She became an organizer working for black liberation attorneys, and she has been an attorney now for decades. She's got 20 years experience, over 20 years experience, directing black social justice organizations. And we talk about everything from, you know, the George Floyd protests, how Trump's using the protest to his advantage, conservatives versus liberals, Trump's record on black rights, and also about defund the police.
All right, should we have a listen?
Let's have a listen.
I'm recording. I've been recording.
Recording backup. I'm recording on Zoom and on Audio Hijack. Recording on the Marantz. We cannot mess this up. Well, look, you're a bit of a radio personality, so you've done this before. This is not new for you, doing a podcast. You're an expert.
This is not new for me, no. Glad to do it, though.
Nana, let's start with George Floyd. You know, the Black Lives Matter protests didn't start with George Floyd. We've seen them, you know, a few years ago with Philando Castile and Alton Sterling, and, you know, I could go on and on and on, but there's been a resurgence, and I want to know what you see, if anything, that's different this time.
You have people who previously were skeptical, people who previously maybe felt hopeless, people who previously thought that they could turn their back or put their head in the sand, understanding that, no, this can't happen anymore. And so you saw this great outpouring, not just of black folks, which, you know, I think it's important that black folks are centered and prioritized and that they lead this movement, but you saw all kinds of people all over the world having a clearer vision based upon that work that's been done over the years and being able to connect with that vision and with that outrage and with the horror and with the hurt and the trauma that black folks were feeling. So that's on that end. On the opposition, they also adjust, right? We're not boxing against a wood figure. So they move too.
This is still an unlawful assembly. You're subject to arrest or citation.
And they've moved in the way of being much more federal policing oriented. We see BORTAC, which is the border SWAT, basically, and ICE coming in to back up or to do beyond what local law enforcement is doing. And so the stakes have been raised on both sides.
How long y'all got to hold him down?
Why don't do drugs, kids?
It ain't about drugs, bro.
Y'all don't got to put on it. Right.
I mean, this must be frustrating for you to see that, you know, how many people does it take to be killed for there to be more of an upswell of people supporting this movement. So in other words, this predates cell phone footage, presumably, and it's just the fact that everybody has a camera phone now means that this is in the public consciousness. Is that frustrating, that it just takes so many of these incidents to happen and for us to see them and for it to become so visceral, for actually people to kind of give a shit?
I mean, I think that it can be frustrating. I'm not so frustrated because I'm old as dirt and twice as funky. So I've been doing this for a minute. And so I actually feel hopeful, right? Mm. But as Mariam Makaba, abolitionist and one of our leaders and teachers teaches us, hope is a discipline. So as a person who's engaged in this movement work, you know, you have to get that discipline of hope so that you cannot get frustrated. But yes, I can understand where the frustration comes from, because this is basic. There's nothing that people are seeing now that is new. There's nothing that people are talking about in terms of what the problems are systemically, what, you know, anti-blackness, white supremacy, plantation capitalism, which is the only kind of capitalism. You know, all of these issues are issues, you know, anti-trans sentiment and homophobia. I mean, all of these things are things that people have been talking about. So it's nothing shocking about it. And so that part can feel like, goodness gracious, as you said, how many people have to die? You know, why do you have to see what has almost become its own form of pornography in a way, right? Mm. Violence porn. Why do you have to see that over and over again in order to get moving on these things? But we also understand that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice, as King teaches us, another leader and teacher. And so we move on, you shoulder on. But it is interesting how many Black people have to die in order to get any kind of movement of the needle when it comes to racial justice.
Mm. Trump is using the protest to his advantage. I mean, I'm wondering whether you think that's working for him.
Our nation has been gripped by professional anarchists, violent mobs, arsonists, looters, criminals, rioters, Antifa.
I don't think that's working for him with folks that are not already in his base. And so, you know, to the degree that Trump loves to rile up his base so that they can be like, oh, hail the king, then yes, it's working for him because he gets to hear the roar of the crowd, right? But in terms of whether he's going to win an election because he castigates folks who are protesters or criminalizes protests, I don't know. You know, I don't think that that's going to work. I do think that as organizers, as mobilizers, as protesters, that we have to take these attacks and this effort to criminalize protests seriously, not because of what it means for the election, but because of what it means for us.
Well, what about there's sort of a darker side to this and to Trump's rhetoric on this stuff? And that's the escalation that we saw back in August when a white teenager shot three Black Lives Matter protesters in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and two of them died. Is it even safe to be a Black Lives Matter protester in America today?
Well, you know, it's not safe to be a Black person in America today. I think that in terms of a protest, again, in support of Black lives, that's always been a dangerous thing to do. We can't just act like this is fun and games. There's a chant that they say, you think this is a game, you think it's a joke. We can't think it's a game. We can't think it's a joke. We got to take that part of security more seriously.
You heard Mike Pence, when he was asked to say Black Lives Matter, said all lives matter.
All lives matters.
And you see these Blue Lives Matter flags up, the Protect the Police or Support the Police flags. Is this a genuine misunderstanding of what the term Black Lives Matter means, or is it something more nefarious? And second part of that question, what would you say to somebody who's a conservative voter who says, I don't know what you mean, like all lives should matter?
No one is confused about what that means. If you ask anyone to pretend that they're in a criminal trial in which they're being accused of a crime, and they can have any avatar to be them, and then you put up the avatars, and one of the avatars or two of the avatars were a Black man, a Black woman, a Black trans woman or gender nonconforming person. And you said, now, and then there's a bunch of white people, and you said, who do you pick? None of these conservative voters would be like, I picked the Black man. That would never happen. because they're clear that you don't want to be the black person. You don't want to be the black trans person. You don't want to be the black disabled person that is facing trial, period, right, in a criminal case. So they know what is they're talking about. They know they don't want to be that black person being pulled over by the police. They're clear about that. That's a ruse. It is an effort to distract. It's an effort to play the game of, you know, reverse racism and anti-affirmative action, all those games that white supremacists have been playing for a while to try to portray themselves as the victim and to try to act as if discrimination is not happening, racism is not happening, anti-blackness is not happening, and white supremacy is not happening. And again, that's more for their base because they know themselves that they don't feel that way. I mean, as pale as Pence makes himself have to be, he knows he is not trying to even be tan, let alone black. And so this conversation about, you know, all lives matter being somehow some superior position, he knows is fallacious.
Mm. What do you think the average Trump voter is afraid of? Is it that they don't like to see one group of people thinking that another group of people are getting an unfair advantage over them? Is that the reason for the resistance? What are they worried about here?
So I wouldn't just limit it to Trump voters. I think what they express it, right? They're expressing it. They're finding a home. They're finding a church home in the church of Trumpology, you know? And so they're sitting in that church home amening, right? But this is an issue that is countrywide. And the fear is based upon this need to have this country be thought of, even if it's not true, right? The perception that this country is a white ethno state, that white people are in charge, that white people are prioritized, that white people are protected, that white people are, you know, provided with relief. And so all over the world, you know, when you say Americans, what comes to people's brain is white people. Even though when you say American music, any form that they think of, from rock and roll to rap to jazz, is black music, right? When you talk about American sports, you know, I'm not saying there's no white people that play sports, but come on, folks are thinking about LeBron. They're thinking about American football players, right? They're thinking about Kobe, rest in peace. This is what's happening, you know? But so what is the disconnect? The disconnect is that what has been put out there about America and what America looks like is darn near, I wish they all could be California girls, you know, that Beach Boys type of perception. And that is what they don't want to lose, is the stake that they've made in this country belonging to them, in spite of the fact that from the beginning it wasn't theirs. You know, they met non-white people when they came here and they brought more non-white people to the place. So it's never been a white ethno state, and it's hard for them to hear anyone giving them any hope that that's what it could be. They're running to.
The biggest gathering London has seen in weeks, and one of the most passionate.
Nana, when you look at the TV pictures of support for Black Lives Matter in terms of protests abroad, you know, you've seen sympathetic protests in London, sympathetic protests in Paris, all across the world. What does that say to you?
Well, it says to me that Black people all over the world, you know, what we already know is that Black people all over the world are facing the same kind of white supremacy and oppression, and that they and their allies are clear about that. And so the description, the call for Black lives to be protected, to be prioritized, the call to us, because Black Lives Matter is a call to Black people. It was a love letter to Black people to remind us, to affirm for us that our lives mattered. That desire, that need to hear that, to know that, to be affirmed and to be reminded is experienced by Black people all over the world. And that's why you see that response.
Did you experience racism growing up?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm a Black person, right? And I mean, the thing was, I remember, it's very interesting. Every summer we would go home. So there was a one time period that we lived in Cote d'Ivoire, and then we would come here for the summer. But when we lived in the United States, every summer we would go to Ghana. And I remember my friends from all ages, you know, all time periods, would always have a comment. Someone would always comment about when I came back, how I looked different, how I sounded different, how I had some kind of, you know, healthy African arrogance. They were like asking me, you know, what is that about? And it occurred to me, every minute that you are a Black person in this country, you are living under some kind of cloud, even in the sunny days, of white supremacy, of the intentions of white supremacy, of the intentions of plantation capitalism. And so when I would go home, it was like the one time when I got to really, really be free in my mind. And of course, we know God has neocolonialism, plantation capitalism is up and well, but there was a certain energy, the lack of motivation and intentionality of white supremacy. You can feel it. There is a difference as a Black person. And so yes, I've experienced racism. I've experienced anti-Blackness. I've experienced it my entire life. And thank goodness that, you know, and I thank the ancestors and the Abosom that I've had the capacity to be able to go home, the privilege, and escape it every once in a while.
There's been a personal trauma, which you've just described, but then also activism is tough work. And you've obviously, you know, it's pretty traumatic being an attorney as well and dealing with the sorts of stuff that you deal with. How are you able to remain so bubbly and positive? I'm assuming that you're always like this.
So I'm not always like this. Sometimes I have a stiff drink in my
Is that what you're doing now? I just out of shot.
No. But sometimes I have a stiff drink in my hand and I'm singing the blues. But generally speaking, really the optimism comes from the love of the comrades. You know, when you are feeling like this is difficult, you know, you wake up. And now it's like every hour. I keep saying you wake up, but it's not even wake up. When, you know, we're done with this interview, we're going to look at the news and we're going to find that there's some other horror that's happening. And so the comrades are really important. You're the capacity for that I have to reach out to by comrades, whether it's the comrades at Baji, you know, at the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, whether it's my stomp down Pan-African, New African revolutionary comrades of the National Conference of Black Lawyers or Black August Los Angeles, you know, or my friends, my sisters are like my brother and my son are like my greatest cheerleaders. So family, you know, my father, my stepmom. You have to definitely connect with people who understand you, who know you, who you trust, who you know that you have built relationship with, that you share core values with, to be able to give each other the sunshine that we need in order to keep moving.
Let's move on to the president. He questioned Obama's citizenship.
He's been taking to the airways to continually question President Obama's birth certificate. What's he up to?
Referred to African countries as shitholes.
Why do we want these people from, quote, all these shithole countries here?
He was seemingly happy to receive the backing of white supremacists. What's your assessment of Trump's record on Black rights?
Oh, yeah, his record is dismal. He really is almost... And, it, you know, it's serious. So when I say these words, it may seem odd, but it's almost like a cartoon caricature of the evil Black hating villain. You know, it's almost as if they sit around the table, he and his advisors, and they take bets on who can come up with the most diabolical way that they can cause trauma to the Black community today. This is not new. You know, sometimes people want to make it seem as if he has these new advisors that have come in, you know, with his presidency that have made him this way. No, this man had lawsuits being filed against him for discriminating against Black people in his housing, right? And so this is something that he has been doing for a long time. This is him. The fact that he has Black friends, that he may have had sexual intercourse with Black women, you know, or Black girls, since, you know, there's some allegations about that too. Those things do not take away from the fact that he is a stone cold racist and anti-Black and means Black people very much harm, whether they be in this country or whether they be on the continent or whether they be in the Caribbean, you know, wherever we are, he means us harm.
What about Obama? There was some criticism that he didn't do enough for the black struggle, that he was sort of trying to position himself as a neutral arbiter in racial matters.
Across the country, the African-American community continues to struggle, even during President Obama's time in office.
The unemployment rate for African-Americans has barely moved from when the president took over at the height of the financial crisis.
Were things better under Obama?
I would say yes to both, right? I would say that things were, you know, in terms of better, people were not, you know, going to protests and just killing people and walking home, you know what I'm saying? And moving on and having folks describe them as heroes from the highest levels of government. So in that way, you could say, you know, we at least had some room. But clearly, there was an effort by President Obama to seem like the neutral, highly intellectual, you know, sort of gentleman, which means that you cannot confront or you're not going to be confronting anti-blackness and white supremacy head on, because that requires being ready, willing to get your hands dirty, which is definitely not where he was. Do I think that that's because he wasn't feeling the pain? Hell no, not possible. I'm not saying he's an uncaring person. I think that there is a mask that he has been required to wear as a person who grew up as the only black person in the family, who, you know, and had to deal with the racism of America basically by himself, in terms of, remember those comrades and cadre I was talking about that help you deal with the trauma? He didn't have that growing up. He didn't have that for much of his, you know, development years. And so I think he's just learned to have that mask, and that was brought into the presidency, so that this thing of being neutral and intellectual and academic is part of that mask. I don't know how you shake that off when you've been wearing that so long.
During the past 2 weeks of protests over the death of George Floyd, we've been hearing and seeing more and more of the slogan, defund the police.
De-escalate police violence by, in some cases, replacing police with community advocates.
It's painted in huge block letters on city streets from Washington to Wisconsin.
There's a call to defund the police, which, you know, my understanding is has been misconstrued in some quarters as being a demand to basically completely defund the police and abolish the police. My understanding is that most people asking for defunding the police are not talking about that. They're talking about reapportioning some money in various communities from the police to mental health services, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I wondered if you could just sort of explain a bit about defund the police and what it means to you.
Okay, excellent. Thank you for this question. Woof, because there's so much confusion about that. Defund the police is a demand that comes as part of abolition. It actually does mean defund the police into no police. That is the goal. The ultimate goal is to not have police. It is really an attack on the system of policing at its very root in the United States, from the local to the federal level. Most people cannot imagine a world without police. And so it's not a very politically stable position to take. And so what we have, you know, happening is people saying, okay, if we talk about defund the police into abolition, folks get too nervous. And they, you know, we don't have the alternative, because people want an alternative department or something, which is not what abolition looks like. But because we haven't gotten people there yet, what we're going to talk about instead is, you know, taking those smaller steps. So let's get people used to the idea that the police do not need to take up 51% of the budget, right? And to talk about what we would do that is feasible right now with the money, if we had the money to do it. And so what we see now, which I call abolition light, right, you know, diet abolition that we see happening now, is the effort to do what had to happen in order to get all those people in the streets that I was talking about before. You've got to get people used to the concepts and to the understandings to get to those concepts and understandings. We can't go faster than the people. That's not what you're trying to do. You've got to talk to the people and come to some understanding with the people, right? With the people leading the conversation about how we get to this place. But the people who still feel like we need the police in some kind of way, right? Black people that still feel that way, what they can wrap their brain around at this moment is the police don't have to have all the money, and that there are other places this money could go that would contribute to our safety and security. And so that's where, you know, we're supporting those efforts that, you know, the people are comfortable with at this point. But absolutely, the goal is to have no cops, no caging, all levels.
How would that work? I mean, realistically, Nana, there would be some, you know, moderate Democrats even listening to this going, that's ludicrous. Like, I, you know, what happens if someone's breaking into my home? I mean, does this mean that we're all going to be arming ourselves to the teeth even more than Americans already are to look after our own safety? I mean, who comes when I've been burgled? Who comes when my car's been broken into?
So I think that part of the answer to that question, you know, is rooted in a better understanding of what police do. When you call the police, do it because your house is being burgled. Do you actually think the police are going to get there to stop the burglar?
No, but I mean,
because
police
that's
do.
Not
police,
what happens.
No, no, no. But police do. I mean, you know, like, let's say somebody was murdered in the house down the street. They're probably not gonna get there and catch the murderer in the process of doing it, right? But the police do more than that. I mean, they have detectives. That's part of the police force, and they're gonna hopefully find the person that did it and arrest them and put them in prison because they don't want them to murder anyone else. So
right. So that's an investigation. So the question is, if there's a violation against the community, who's going to investigate that? What do we want the people that are going to investigate that to do? And I don't have the answer. Otherwise, I'd be the leader of the abolitionist world, right? But this is the direction that we need to be moving in.
So it sounds like a sort of utopian vision for the future. And it's one that, you know, you're sort of saying, I mean, it goes back to the mass incarceration of black people for low level, you know, drug crimes in the 90s and stuff like that, which, I mean, I think a lot of people kind of think was ridiculous and very heavy handed. So just to be completely clear, are you sort of thinking of this as a sort of kind of ideal world scenario where we abolish the current system of policing and prisons and then erect something brand new that deals with the very worst offenders that we know need to be locked up because we don't want that 10% out on the streets, but doesn't treat the kind of low-level offenders in the way that we have been?
I don't want anyone to be locked up. That's my position. I don't want anyone to be locked up. I think that detention is torture, and I don't see why we are torturing people because we're upset that they have engaged in crimes. I don't think it's something that's utopian in the sense that you see folks that are doing it, that we have examples of people that are doing it in their own ways right now, and examples of people that have been doing it, whether it be because they're insular communities, right? Like, you know, or because they have sat down and figured out, for example, in the areas of gender violence and sexual violence, that, hey, there is another way for us to approach this as opposed to subjecting both the victim, the survivor, and the harmed person to this trauma. And, you know, people can go look it up, do the research, basic Google search will get you to some of these efforts that people are successfully engaging in now, that in which they are taking themselves into a completely cop-free, cage-free way of addressing serious harm.
George Floyd's last words, but they didn't die with him. They're still being heard, echoing all across this nation. They speak to a nation where too often, just the color of your skin puts your life at risk.
Okay, so how easy, if Biden gets in, would it be to undo this sort of racially charged environment under Trump?
I don't think it's going to be easy because I think that just as a lot of the racial charge that you see is the result of President Obama being president, right? A black man being president for 8 years. If Trump loses, that the people that back him are going to take that as a shot across the bow, right? And that they're actually going to step it up. And he's going to be on the sidelines, stepping it up with Trump Entertainment and Fox News and all of that. And I think that we need to be prepared. We need to be ready. the Biden administration, if Biden is brought in, is going to have to make some decisions about whether it's going to be that neutral mask face or whether it's going to actually work to protect Black people and other people of color in this country who are rising up in support of our lives.
And what if Trump gets back in?
Well, if Trump gets back in, instead of it going to be, you know, this white backlash, it's going to be doing a celebratory run around the lap on our heads. And he's definitely going to see that as a mandate to keep doing what he's doing. And he's going to accelerate. And we're going to see folks in the streets in support of him and in opposition. And we're going to have to rely way more or be clearer on the need to rely on ourselves, because certainly we're not going to be relying on the federal government to help. And in most of this country, we're not going to be able to rely on the states to help. Everyone is not, you know, in a place in which the state is not complicit with white supremacy. In fact, all these states are to some degree. I think that in a place like California, that Governor Newsom would be hard pressed to not do something that was helpful, but we'll see. You know, we'll find out. Everyone will get dunked in hot water, and we'll see what kind of tea we're really sipping here.
I wonder whether you see this as a sort of, whether Trump does get in again, or even if he doesn't, the last 4 years of Trump was a case of, you know, one step back, two steps forward, and whether you're still hopeful for the future.
I definitely am still hopeful for the future. In fact, even more so because I see opposition. There has been resistance from the very beginning, right? And the resistance has come from different folks. It has come, you know, more people have been added to that number of saints that are marching in, right? And so that's really hopeful. One thing, if we saw everyone kind of going into their house and crawling into their attic and saying, I don't know what we're going to do. But it's really been the opposite. People have really been talking in ways that we haven't heard in a long time. People are reaching back to ideas that they've seen have worked in the past, when, you know, talking about cross movement building in ways that they haven't done in a long time. And so I do see it as a time that reminded people that the fight is not over, and maybe shook some of the dust off of some folks and got them back in the game. And for folks who didn't even know that this was what was happening, that this game was being played, you know, they've read the rule book and they've jumped in. And so some have jumped in without reading the rule book, just knowing that they've got to get in. And so all of that makes me hopeful in spite of what has been happening. But I do think we need to take this moment really seriously, whatever level of seriousness we think about it at, we need to raise that about five times.
Nana, it's been fantastic speaking to you. I really appreciate your time, and it was good meeting you, and best of luck.
Thank you. Appreciate you. This was lovely. Thank you so much, Alan.
Thanks a lot.
Alex, I can't believe how positive and cheerful Nana was.
Considering the area that she is working in, I agree.
She said she was old as hell and twice as funky. I think that applies to you as well. It's actually your birthday today, so you're definitely old as hell and definitely twice as funky.
Funky as hell and twice as old. I'm 46 today, Pete.
I know you are. I sang Stevie Wonder to you earlier.
Isn't she lovely?
Anyway, we spoke to Nana before the first presidential debate, which at the time of recording was 2 days ago, in which Trump refused to condemn the actions of the Proud Boys. With that in mind, I mean, are there any solutions to be found in this massive culture war at the moment?
No, he's decided to use this as a tool to hit the left with. His is the party of law and order. He's the president of law and order. The left are kind of encouraging this rioting and this looting, and look at these democratic run cities, which frankly, as was pointed out to him, is not just democratic run cities that this is happening in. And by far and away, it's largely peaceful protesters and, you know, mums and dads and kids protesting as well. But it's become a divisive election issue. It's not going to get any better before the election, because he's deliberately turned it into an election issue.
And when Nana was talking about defund the police, she perhaps took it a bit further than you initially thought the concept stood for. What did you think about what she was saying? You know, literally getting rid of the police.
No, I think a lot of people, even on the left, will sort of be kind of baffled by that. But here's my take. I think that the vast, doesn't really matter, because the vast majority of people who are backing the Black Lives Matter protests and who understand the term defund the police to be, shouldn't we look at budgets and apportion some of the budgets that are going to police to mental health care, et cetera, social welfare. That's what they think and that's what they want. And the fact is there are two people running in the presidential election, Donald Trump and Joe Biden. Joe Biden does not want what Nana is asking for. However, I think she's got this utopian vision of a future where we don't incarcerate black men in the numbers that we have. And, you know, policing is something that we need to address, and that she has this vision for the future where, you know, we look at mental health care more than we look at, you know, strong arm of the law. So I think it's an idealistic vision, but it's one that she's sort of striving for. And I think we need to look at what she said in that sort of context.
Do you have any hope for the future?
As far as this is concerned, I keep thinking back to something a friend of mine, Kevin Ashton, once told me. And Kevin's a writer. He coined the phrase the Internet of Things. So he was a sort of techie guy before. And he wasn't talking, I'll be very clear, he wasn't talking about racism in America or Black Lives Matter. He was talking about science and innovation. But what he said, I think, is really pertinent. He said, it's a bit like one of those rides that you let your kid go on. You can make it go a little faster or a little slower, but you can't really control it much more than that. So his point is that government can definitely have an effect. And those that are anti-Trump, you know, would say that's a negative effect. But progress and change will happen regardless, because it's driven by people.
Well, that is interesting now. And final question, how is this issue going to influence the election?
The youth of today, Pete. You know, I was just reading the other day about this Harvard youth poll found that 63% of Americans between the ages of 18 and 29 said they would definitely be voting in November. And if that's the case, that would be a massive increase from 2016 and 2018, and could even exceed the numbers of young people that voted for Obama in 2008. So I'm hedging a bit, but the polls were wrong in 2016. So we'll have to see.
All right, Al, I think that's enough for now. We're back next week, aren't we?
We are. Back with another battleground.
On Monday. See you later, Al.
Bye, Pete. Battleground is presented by me, Alex Hannaford. The producer and sound engineer is Pete Sale. The theme music is Three Girls by Hidden Twin. Battleground is a DMT Media production for Audioboom.